Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast. And if you hear me doing the introduction, you're probably aware that Mayu is not with us in today's preamble. It's just going to be myself, Austin, running the preamble. But don't fret, because it's going to be both of us on the actual content. And today, a lot of news coming out this week. I think the biggest one, of course, was the Bank of Canada deciding to hold rates at 5% for April's hearing. Don't think anyone was shocked. No one should have expected a rate cut. It's way too soon for that. However, during the presser, there were a lot of questions around rate cuts in June. So Tiff Macklin was fending off the media questions. First one off the bat was if he's expecting to cut rates in June. And pretty much he said it's within the realm of possibility that they will cut rates in June. The data has been promising so far. From a Canadian point of view, inflation is surprising to the downside, which is great. Core inflation is making great progress. Headline inflation has made great progress as well. Although for the most part, they expect headline inflation to still hover above 30%, mainly because they're expecting gas prices to continue to increase. However, there's been great, again, progress on the core inflation side, and they expect that progress to continue. Furthermore, the jobs report showed promising data, meaning that we ended up shedding jobs instead of adding jobs, which we expected, which is obviously good news from the point of view of it pushes a likelihood of a rate cut. Obviously not good news for the individuals who lost their job, but solely from a rate cut point of view, that's sort of what the Bank of Canada wants to see. And on top of that, GDP has been rolling down, especially GDP per capita, which has been decreasing and negative over the last couple of quarters. So all promising data for a rate cut in June. And Tiff basically said that as long as the data continues to improve within the next couple of months, and so and it's not just one-off readings, then we should suspect a June rate cut. However, at that same day, there was also U.S. inflation data. And U.S. is a totally different story than Canada. Canada, our economy's essentially rolling over, whereas the U.S. is proven to be much more resilient than expected, continuously breaking economists' expectation. Not only is GDP surprising on the upside in the U.S., the jobs report surprised on the upside, where they expected somewhere around 200,000 jobs added to the U.S. economy, but then they ended up adding over 300,000 jobs, which is obviously not great. Shows that the U.S. economy is performing much stronger than anticipated. Not only are we seeing improvements in the labor market in the States, but also inflation is surprising on the upside, which is terrible news. Inflation data came in on the U.S. on Wednesday, and it came in at 3.5%. which is up from 3.2% in the month prior. And also, it was 0.1% higher than analysts' expectations. On top of that, core inflation is remaining much stickier. It came in at 3.8%, where the market forecasted 3.7%. So the odds of a June rate cut in the US is slowly slipping out its hand. Prior to that, the US was not, I wouldn't say adamant, but the US was expecting 3 rate cuts in the year, with the first one being in June. But of course, with inflation continuing to be stronger than expected, doesn't really leave room for a rate cut. And this puts Canada in sort of a tough position between saving the Canadian economy and Canadian consumers, who are obviously over-leveraged, versus deciding to keep rates higher for longer with lockstep of the US. Because again, like, it's going to be tough for Canada to diverge too much from the US's decisions on rate cuts. Because if they do, that's going to devalue the Canadian currency and may cause us to import inflation as a result of that, which is obviously not great. But that being said, that question about Canadian dollar devaluation was actually asked in the press as well. And Tiff Macklin, although acknowledging that it is definitely a real risk and something that they're monitoring, it's not something that's going to dictate immediately the rate cut decision in the short term. It seems like that's going to be based off the Canadian data, which again, seems promising. So there's still a possibility that we see rate cuts in June in Canada. Because again, we're a totally different market than the US, but how much are we going to cut rates? That's going to be ultimately dependent on how much the Federal Reserve is going to cut rates this year. I don't think we can be far from that. And as a result of the US inflation news, that actually pushed up the Canadian 5-year bonds Now we're hovering well above 3.7% again. And so we're going to see mortgages, fixed mortgages all across the board shoot up within the next couple of days, if it hasn't already. And on top of that, it's going to probably be very difficult or maybe nearly impossible to get fixed rate below the 4% once again, because of this terrible news on the US side. Anyways, that's enough rambling for me today. I hope you guys enjoyed those quick updates. We have Dan Iles on the podcast, who was with us in one of our earlier episodes, but he's back with us again to talk all about real estate development, giving updates on his journey. As you guys are probably aware, Dan owns and operates a sub-metering company, but also expanded into doing land severances. And most recently with his land severances, he decided to develop on it as well. We go into some of the hurdles of getting into real estate development. We get into developing into secondary markets, because a lot of people talk about developing in Toronto or larger markets, but the numbers also make sense in some secondary, tertiary markets as well. And Dan gets into some of the due diligence he does before jumping into development to secondary markets. We get into a couple of projects that he's working on, how the numbers are shaking out, and also his learning lessons along the way in development, and how it could be useful in your tool set as a real estate investor. Because whether you like it or not, it seems to be the numbers are getting a lot more difficult in the purpose-built multifamily side, especially when you have tenants that are already staying there. There's a risk of turning them around if you're not able to do that. It's just impossible to make the numbers work in a decent amount of risk. And so, or not impossible, but it's pretty difficult. And so there's been a large push in development. A lot of real estate investors are moving into the development side because they have more control for the end-to-end process and more control over the pro forma. Anyways, hope you guys enjoy this episode. Make sure to leave us a 5-star review, comment, share with a friend. And without further ado, we're going to jump into today's episode. Just a heads up before we get started, this podcast is all about providing you information, not financial or legal advice. So if you need the real deal for your situation, hit up a professional. We can't promise you our information is always up to date or accurate, and we're not responsible for any investment decisions you make based on it. Markets change, information change, you know the drill. Anyways, thank you for hanging out with us responsibly. Let's jump right on in. Hello, everyone. We are joined with our very special guest, and it's been 2 years since the day, Dan Iles. Dan, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back on the podcast.
For sure, Dan. So for anyone that doesn't know, we had Dan on episode 68, just kind of talking about severance and redevelopment. At that time, very different market. It's been just over 2 years, and I had the opportunity to hear Dan speak recently, and he's been up to a lot of shit. So it made the most sense to bring you back, Dan. But for anyone that might not have caught that episode, episode 68, why don't you give us kind of a quick background on yourself, if you remember where you were at that point in time, and then, you know, we can talk about what you've been up to since then.
For sure. So when I last spoke with you guys, I had recently left my job to go into real estate investing full time. Happy to announce I'm still unemployed. I had recently quit my job. I was starting my very first construction project. I had a couple severances under my belt. Since then, I built my first multifamily property from the ground up, to which I general contracted myself. I've severed other properties, both for myself and for other investors. And I've continued to operate my water submetering business that we spoke about last time as well.
Right. Yeah. I completely forgot about the water submetering business. So that's pretty interesting too. Yeah, let's talk about that first one. That at that time, I think you were severancing and you had started maybe digging. That was your first kind of build slash severance play, I think, right? Yeah, what happened with that one, I guess, just kind of like talking about off the last one.
So that one there, that was my very first real estate investment. And what it ended up being was kind of a small land assembly. So my parents had a property. I bought the one next door. We were able to sever off two building lots. So that's kind of how I first got into this whole thing. 2 years ago, I was just getting ready to excavate to start construction. So I spent the vast majority of 2022 building a pair of semi-detached houses in the city of Woodstock. Like I said, I general contracted the whole thing myself. Took about 8 months when it was all said and done, but I did successfully complete the build. I wanted to build 4 units right off the get-go, but I ran into some challenges with the city on that. So what I ended up building, at least at the initial phase in 2022, was 2 semis, and I've got them both rented out. So that project went well, but it wasn't without challenges, as I'm sure anybody doing their first build would encounter. But I got there.
Yeah, would love to dig down on some of those challenges. And let's start from the basics. Like, why didn't you decide to build instead of flip? Because we know a lot of people who buy sort of these properties, they sever the lot and they sell it, and they say that they get to keep a free building. But you went the other way around. You're like, I'm going to sever it and I'm going to keep that building plus and develop on this land I have now. So how did the math work out, and what was the due diligence behind that?
So I've also flipped land as well, and I know we talked about that a little bit last time. My thought was, I wanted something to generate long-term wealth. And when you can get the land for very minimal money by taking it off properties that you already own, that's kind of the cheapest, easiest, kind of most training wheels way you're ever going to get into development. So that was my reasoning for keeping that one specifically.
I mean, like, also, do you have an idea, had you sold it as just land, what it would have been worth? And then you might have got this number when you were going through construction financing or so, right? But what was the land worth? And then, having developed it, what is it incrementally worth now, right? And I guess, or is the answer just, hey, you just developed it because you wanted a new build, right? Which is fine too. Like, I think that makes sense.
It's definitely a little bit of all of those, right? Like, I wanted a new build under my belt. It seemed like a valuable skill to acquire and a great process to go through. But ultimately, I believe when I first severed the two lots, they would have been worth a combined about $350,000, right? So that's a huge leg up when you get that land for essentially the cost of a survey and a severance application. So yeah, I built out the whole thing. The market did come down, as everyone's aware, in 2022. So maybe not quite as frothy as I first envisioned, but that $350,000 in land value, or what can be viewed as equity today, it's still there. And if not, a little higher than that.
Right. Okay, gotcha. And then how did you go about financing your first build? And what was the cost associated with the development?
So this one here, I actually self-financed the build. So I used cash that I had generated, well, from flipping other pieces of land that I had severed, and a couple home equity lines of credit. So it's my understanding that when you're doing a small build like this, and especially when it's your first one and you don't have a track record, it can be difficult to get a construction loan. So I didn't even bother with that, and went straight to the resources I already had. As far as cost goes, before HST, the build came to around $670, somewhere in there, for the two semis. So again, that's before HST. There's a lot of moving parts there, but that's kind of the quick and dirty version.
$670 for the two semis combined, right?
Yeah.
And you built these. So for anyone that does, I think describing the property and taking a step back here, it's, your parents' house was a corner lot, right? And then you bought their backyard neighbor, essentially, right? So that house was also a corner lot. And then what you severed was out of the backyards of both houses a little bit, right? And you put those together to make the set, right?
Yeah, that's more or less correct.
Okay, cool. And so when you built it for $670, and sorry, what did you say what it was appraised for now? Or
it appraised for $1.26 million. When it was all
okay. So once you factor in like HSC, all that stuff, maybe around like $770 or so, right? So still about like a $400,000 lift, which is similar to the land value from back then. But I guess there's, because they're two semis, do you plan to duplex them in the near future? Like, what's the thought process there? Because you're not far away from four units.
Yeah. So I'm actually right in the middle of turning those two basements into additional units. So when it's all said and done, I will have kind of created a de facto fourplex. I guess what it really is it's two semi-detached duplexes. So that's what I'm doing right now. And kind of as I talked about earlier, I wanted to do it all at the time of construction, but ran into some challenges with doing the basement units back in 2022 when I built this.
Could we walk through some of those challenges that you faced?
Yeah, definitely. So just to go back on what was going on at that time, Bill 108 had recently come out, which, to sum it up, permitted secondary dwelling units across all sorts of properties here in Ontario. And then I had put forward building up, building permit applications. And I put forward applications that showed the basements as being their own units. And the city said, no, they said just straight up, we don't allow it. And it was kind of unfortunate because a few friends of mine had actually built this exact same pair of semis in St. Catharines a few years prior. And they were allowed to just go ahead and build all four units right off the hop. A little deflating to see what's going on in one city, and then an hour down the road, it's not the same case. So anyways, I decided to leave the basement units on the back burner with the understanding that I'll get there someday. And so I moved forward with the building permits as just a pair of semis. And like I said, I constructed that in 2022. And I then applied to finish the basement units kind of shortly after construction. Not a whole ton different than anybody with any run-of-the-mill house looking to convert their basement to an additional unit. But the city continued to push back on me really hard. And at this point now...
Didn't they give any reason why they were pushing back?
Yeah, they did. I was just going to add one thing. So now at this point here, Bill 23 has come out and it's now law. So when I'm putting forward these applications to turn the two basements into secondary dwelling units, Bill 23 is not really being honored in the way that we all know it to be. The problem I ran into is they kept citing parking, saying that I didn't have enough parking. And I know I'm not the first to come on a podcast and talk about parking challenges. But yeah, that's what it ended up being.
Yeah, interesting. So where do you go from here? Because, you know, obviously with the province allowing it, the local municipality not, highest and best use for this property, I'd imagine, because you said it wouldn't stop, right? Four units would be, I have no idea what it would be for, right? But going to definitely be hiring that 1.2, right? So where do you go from here? How do you get it to that final fourplex stage?
The one thing I'll add too is when I first started building these at the beginning of 2022, that was before interest rates went up at all, right? And I should have been able to kind of carry the property just on the two main units. But as we all know, interest rates went up, up, and up that year. Right. So all of a sudden, these basement units, where they were kind of a nicety at one point, they're now a necessity.
Right.
So just kind of a further backstory on this, what ended up happening was the city has a requirement for two parking spaces per dwelling, and then they require one parking space per additional residential unit. And so each of my semi-detached driveways can hold four cars plus one in the garage. You can park five vehicles in each one. The problem I ran up against was they wouldn't recognize the first 18 feet of the driveway because it's technically boulevard. And although the driveway was wide enough to fit two cars side by side, it wasn't quite wide enough on paper. So when I had to submit a site plan, the city kept telling me that I only had two parking spaces when anybody driving by could easily see you could fit four cars plus one in the garage. So
what do you think it is? Like, is it just a lot of like NIMBYism? Is it Woodstock's not really pro development? And how do people essentially anticipate this for other cities?
I just think sometimes there's some old mentalities on whether it be city councils or committee of adjustments. Not everybody's on board with adding ADUs and infill developments and this kind of stuff. So I wouldn't say Woodstock's against development by any means, but this one provision really seemed to be a sticking point for that municipality in particular.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Gotcha. And any reason why you didn't decide to exit after building it into two semis? So I understand, obviously, the potential to turn it to a four unit, but you were saying that their appraised value was in the low millions. Typically, those are properties that people don't hold, right? They'll flip it. So what was the thought process behind that?
For sure. I was still confident all along that I could get the extra units. I just knew I was going to have to push and push hard for that. I can tell you what I ended up doing, because as I mentioned earlier, I am in the middle of finishing those basement units. I ended up speaking with a number of people at the city, in particular the planning department, and asked about minor variances, whether it's for a parking reduction or a wider driveway. And kept kind of saying no to everything. And that was a little deflating. So I started to go a different route. I ended up actually meeting with my MPP. And I figured that was relevant because it was his government that put forward these policies that a city in his jurisdiction is not honoring. So he was sympathetic, but ultimately told me it's a municipal matter. So from there, the next thing I did, I actually ended up reaching out to the mayor and a couple councilors. They actually came over and checked out my project. I had them down in the basements. I kind of showed them that, hey, this project's right downtown. It was set up to be four units. There's many policies calling for exactly this. And they absolutely acknowledged that. And the mayor and these councilors in particular are actually fairly pro-development. They weren't necessarily my stumbling blocks on this. So from there, some questions were asked around the city. But it still didn't really progress anywhere. And this is where I really had to take matters into my own hands. Also at this point too, I tried hiring some private planners, none of which were really willing to help me on this, whether it was too small or they didn't want to maybe ruffle any feathers at the city. So I had trouble getting help on this. So what I ended up doing was I saw they were having a city council meeting about additional residential units. I went to the meeting, I got up in front of all of council and the mayor, and I stated my case and cited examples and policies from other cities. And later in that week, they actually took my comments and they put it to a vote, and they actually passed it 4-3 and changed their zoning based on my comments.
That's interesting.
Not bad. Then I'm just changing one municipality at a time here.
But it's crazy that you have to go through all of those hoops and hurdles. You have to invite the mayor over. They say no. You have to go to the city council. It's ridiculous. Just ultimately get the same end result, in which they made the issue, from what it sounds like, the parking, which, as you mentioned, practically speaking, wasn't even an issue to begin with.
No, they acknowledged that at the meeting, because when I brought it up, they kind of said, yeah, like, Dan, we saw your property. We're kind of puzzled as how parking was an issue there. So like I said, sometimes you got to be your own biggest advocate, and nobody will fight harder for your project than you will. And sometimes you got to get loud about it. And in this case, right, it paid off.
So Dan, you mentioned private planner. I'm sorry, like, I'm not very well knowledgeable in the development space. What is a private planner? Is that just like a planner, or
sure,
what's the difference?
All municipalities have planning staff. So these are people that oversee zoning regulations and official plan matters, that kind of stuff. There are also private planners as well. So if you kind of think about it, let's use it like a lawyer, for example. You can go hire your own to kind of advocate for you. And it's the same thing with planners. You can hire a private planner to advocate against kind of zoning bylaws and official plans for you and your project.
Understood.
So most people that are going through some sort of zoning amendment, et cetera, you do hire your own planner, right? Like an external planner, which is the same as a private planner, I think, right? So that's pretty cool, Dan. So, I mean, you know, hopefully you get the fourplex component of this project done sooner than later. That was, you know, you started that 2 years ago. It's, you know, obviously with the increasing interest rate environment, I'm sure there were different challenges. Where did you go from there? Did you do one project at a time? Did you take on multiple? Like, what was kind of the process there?
For sure. I've been kind of in the meantime working and helping some other investors get similar projects approved. So when we were just talking about private planners, I do a lot of my own planning work. And so far, I haven't run into too many challenges aside from the one we just spoke about. But yeah, Mayo, I'd echo what you just said there. If you're doing something larger that it requires like a zone change or something like that, you're for sure going to want a private planner. And I wouldn't shy away from hiring one if I ever ran into any real resistance. But what am I working on next, and what have I done since? I've recently acquired another project, and the plan on that one is to build a row of townhouses. So three townhouses, each with a basement unit, for a total of six units. So I was able to acquire a piece of land last year for a really good price. and kind of just going through the approval process on that now.
Could you walk us through how you sort of keep an eye out on these opportunities, and what side of due diligence do you do to figure out the highest and best use of these lots?
For sure. One thing I do a lot of is I'll get some realtor help here and maybe set up some searches that look for like wide frontages or big areas and stuff like that. And that's actually how I found this one specifically. And then, yeah, from there, I just start doing due diligence on this, looking at zoning and size and river conservation authority regulations and infrastructure, which is a big one. And kind of determine from there whether it's a feasible project or not.
Understood.
I guess, how did you find the deal? If we just kind of talk about that component first, right? Like, were these just sitting on the market?
Yeah, this one specifically was just sitting on the market. Just kind of did a search on realtor.ca for some land. And I was able to find what was an 104 foot by 104 foot vacant parcel in the town of Goderich, Ontario, which is a really nice little town on Lake Huron. So that's how I came across that one.
Interesting. Okay, so you're looking at, I'm familiar with Goderich. It's quite small town. Does development make sense in these smaller towns, and does it differ drastically from bigger cities? Because a lot of people are doing it in Toronto, nothing new there. Don't really hear many people seeking opportunities like Goderich. I bet population is probably less than 15,000, right?
Yeah, the population's around 8,000. Here's kind of my philosophy on it. Yeah, I think you got to be cautious with the smaller centers. However, if the smaller center has something going for it, then I'm willing to look at it. So for example, Goderich, I believe it has North America's largest salt mine there. It's got a huge employer. It's on Lake Huron. It's got some really nice beaches there, and it's got a really big and growing retirement demographic.
Yes.
So when I look at a place like Goderich, I'm willing to consider it because it has some stuff going for it. Another thing I would consider doing a small town project is if it's located near a bigger city, if it acts as a bedroom community to a big city, I would have no reservations about doing something like that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to point to. Like that entire area, isn't there like the Bruce power plants or something like that that's going on there? Huge capital expenditures and stuff like that, right? But still, like arguably that is not an area that most people would look at, right? So especially for vacant land, right? Like a lot of times they're looking along the 401 corridor and stuff like that. I think you might have already said your purchase price, but you know, so you find this land, especially in a small city. It's not like they're like zoning, like bylaws are online, or maybe they are, and I'm wrong here, right? But how did you go about doing your due diligence on this? Like, I understand like looking at the, what did you call that? The environmental stuff and all that stuff. I understand that, right? But how did you actually figure out what like zoning would permit here?
And sir, could you repeat the price? I might have missed it actually.
Actually, no, I hadn't said the price. So just quickly on the price, these folks had it listed for $395 in 2022. And I believe they actually accepted an offer on it. And as the market went down, I think the buyer actually walked away from their deposit. When I came across this property, it was earlier in 2023, and they had it listed for $350. I was ultimately able to scoop it up for $290.
Okay, gotcha. And then how did you go about the due diligence on that?
What I ended up doing first off was I have a bit of a leg up when it comes to this due diligence thing, just having a background in urban planning and civil engineering. So I started by kind of reading through the current zoning, coming up with some drawings myself for how I may sever up or develop this property. I started looking at kind of some other small developments in the area. But one of the really interesting things with this one is I was able to lock it up with a due diligence period of 14 days. And when the market was hot, you weren't able to do things like that. And that ended up being a really, really important part of this, because in that 14 days due diligence, I was able to actually get a pre-con meeting with the planning staff. So that was really fruitful, because at that pre-con meeting, planning staff were generally in support of what I put forward. But then they said to me, they said, "Hey, Dan," they said, "we're actually about to change all our zoning. Did you know that?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And I asked if I could get a copy of their new zoning, and they did. And so when I locked up this property, I thought I was going to have to go through the severance and minor variance process, which can take a long time, 6 to 12 months, depending on what conditions they put on you. With their new zoning, I can actually go straight to building permit and skip all of that. So getting that due diligence and having that meeting provided a ton of value.
Hold on. So it was 100 by 140, you said, right?
It's 104 wide by 104 deep. So it's a perfect square.
Okay. And so your initial plan when you ran your numbers was to what? Sever it into three lots or four? Were you going to be able to squeeze out four?
I was going to try and sever it into three. I would have needed a lot of minor variances for that. Where now I don't need any of that. I'm literally working on building permit right now.
So their change to zoning bylaws essentially allowed 100 by 100 to be built into six townhouses anywhere in the city. Is that kind of the move?
In their R2 zoning, it did. And this one specifically is three townhouses, but will be six units with the basement.
Okay. Interesting. So, I mean, even without that, had you had to go through the severance application, the minor variances and so on, I'm assuming the deal worked. And now you just save some funds on all those multiple like planning fees and legal fees for severances and stuff like that, right?
For sure. And in holding costs and everything else involved with that. So it not in one straight up adds monetary value to the project. And two, it just saves you a lot of money in time and effort and potential planning costs.
Interesting. That's it. That's really like being in the right spot at the right time, I guess, right? You know, you had it under contract and then you went through the due diligence process to kind of figure that out. So what is the process from there? Because this is early 2023. Where did you go from there? Did you get the land on a VTB or did you have to close it with your own funds? Or did you raise funds? Like, how did you go about that?
So that one I closed in cash. And there is some advantages to doing that too. When you have a lender involved and you're looking to sever or alter a property, that can really complicate things. So yeah. there is a lot of benefit to holding land in cash when you can. I realize that's not possible on all projects. So yeah, funded that in cash. And then what I've been doing since then is getting drawings put together, started putting out for some quotes, have been in talks with lenders. I do have one letter of intent from one lender to provide a construction loan for this. So kind of going through that process now. And then I've somewhat paused on it because I was finally successful with the other project and getting my basement units. So I kind of circled back on that one for the time being, and then I'll revisit this one kind of as soon as I wrap that one up.
So just want to understand how construction works in the smaller towns, right? Like in places like Woodstock, and again, like larger cities, probably easier to find construction crews to deal with development. In areas like Goderich, is development much more expensive given the fact the materials are less accessible, right? Probably a little bit more expensive on the material side, I imagine. And also, is it true, like this could be off, but labor would generally be more if there's less competition, if there's only really one or two companies that deal with stuff like this?
Sure. So I actually find the opposite. I find it less expensive to build in smaller places. Kind of my own anecdotal experience here. I'm from a real small town near Stratford of about 3,000 people. What I find is, although there's less people, a lot more of them are blue collar, and a lot more people have framing companies, concrete companies, plumbing companies. So I have not had any trouble whatsoever finding companies to come in and do the various construction tasks.
That's interesting. Are you planning to GC it yourself?
Yes, I am, but I'll definitely be doing things differently than I did in Woodstock. I'll be looking to maybe hire some construction management this time, because that one I did in Woodstock, that's about 45, 50 minutes away from me. And it's not the end of the world to hop in the car and go down there when required. Goderich is a lot further. It's about an hour and a half from me. And I refuse to do it the way I did in Woodstock, with constantly being on the road and on site. So a lot of lessons learned on that, and they'll definitely be applied to the next project.
Right. What's the price per square feet on development, and how are you financing it? Is it through some sort of construction loan, private money, or again, through like HELOC and cash?
This next development, the plan is to build it with a construction loan and ideally refinance into the MLI Select program, being as I'll have six units. Yeah, that's kind of the plan on that one.
Gotcha. Interesting. So now that you guys, I know you're kind of tittering back and forth between the two deals, right? And this one you owed in cash. The construction company, I'm assuming construction financing, it doesn't sound like you're getting CMHC. It sounds like you're probably going for more of a traditional, like 70% loan to cost. Is that kind of what you're getting there?
Yeah, and I can definitely speak to that. So I've been working with a broker on the MLI Select side of things, and I've spoken to other investors familiar with this program. One thing I heard a number of times was that kind of the small towns and the more far-flung of a place you're in,
yeah,
less appetite some of these lenders have to finance it.
That's unsurprising. You got an LOI already. So.
Well, then the other side of things too is that I'm also hearing that for the construction financing component, MLI Select really prefers larger projects than just something in the 1 to 2 million range with six units. They're looking for stuff that's, we got another zero on the end of that.
So I'm assuming you went for basically like one of these like private construction lending companies, right? Like Orbos or a bunch of the other options out there, right? But when you go for that, are they giving you like 70% of the as if complete value? Are they giving you like 90 on the construction cost? What kind of terms were you able to negotiate there?
It's been a while since I looked at it, but I believe it's somewhere in the 75% range there. And they, again, the whole owning land in cash thing, they're willing to acknowledge that and offer a little more favorable terms, seeing that it's owned outright.
Right. And just to get a better understanding of the numbers, what are you looking at in terms of costs for this entire development? Not including land acquisition costs, just the build itself.
To build it, I'm probably somewhere in the 1.3, 1.4 range to get all six units built.
Gotcha. And then the land acquisition, which is almost about 300. And what do you think that the property value is going to be around after?
The as constructed appraisal came in at 2.16 million.
Okay, gotcha. And you're going to be taking it to MLI Select after and refining from there.
Yep. There should be lots of built-in equity on day one with this.
So where do you go from here? I mean, is this sort of going to be the bread and butter going forward? Is to buy these lots, turn it to six units or at least 5 units plus and then CMHC?
That would be ideal. And I'm really interested to see how this project goes on that regard. But yeah, the plan is to continue doing these infill development type projects and potentially bigger and bigger ones as I go along. I know we hear about it time and time again. It seems like infill is all the rage these days, and it seems like almost every week there's a new policy supporting infill in some way, shape, or form. And
right.
I think I'll be well served by using some of the skill and experience I have to continue doubling down on this.
For sure. Yeah, it's pretty clear, right? Like the government incentives are being pushed towards a building versus just like buying these purpose-built properties and turning them over. They want to add more supply into the market, which is clear because our economy has a huge demand and supply issue. That being said, I mean, it's interesting how you hop from Woodstock and then found an opportunity in Goderich. And I'm pretty sure there's probably not going to be a ton of other opportunities in Goderich, given it's a pretty small town. Like, where are you going next? And is there going to be a specific market that you just narrow down to and then sort of build economies of scale from there?
That's a great question. Yeah, I've done Woodstock. I've done Goderich. I did a project in Wasaga Beach. So like I'm literally all over the province here. Part of the reason for that is projects like this, I find they're not a dime a dozen. They don't just exist everywhere ready for you to scoop up off the MLS. And sometimes you do have to be willing to move around a little bit and get creative when it comes to finding these things. And I've found in the past too, a lot of the simpler ones where you can maybe just sever a piece of land or tear down a house and rebuild a couple units, they don't really exist in some of the larger cities. All the easy ones have already been done years ago. Yeah. And you might have to look at things like land assemblies and rezonings and stuff like that in the larger centers.
Right. Yeah. I find in Toronto, at least, there's not many lots that support the 4+1 strategy. And when it does, like obviously this is an existing bungalow. So to a certain extent, you're paying land value plus you're actually competing against some home buyers who want to live in the bungalow itself. So the price does get bid up quite a bit. But that being said, I mean, Have you looked into trying to do it in cities like Toronto? Because, I mean, obviously the numbers a lot more expensive, I will say, but also there's that long-term appreciation, right? Because that's where you're really seeing the housing shortage the most.
I haven't looked in Toronto specifically, but I live in Waterloo. And I'm starting to eye up my own city here, Kitchener-Waterloo. Kitchener specifically has been very progressive when it comes to some infill and ADU policies. So I'm definitely starting to have a much harder look in my own backyard. In some of the consulting work I've done with some other investors, Toronto has been challenging at times, notably challenging. And it's a bit of cause for concern, I guess, just from my own experience.
To be able to share what sort of challenges are there?
For sure. So the project I was working on, it was a 12 townhouse project. And I'm not making this up. This has been under the approval process for over 11 years now. So we're not talking a skyscraper. We're not talking a mid-rise.
Yeah.
We're talking 12 townhomes. And you know what? It's still not shovel ready. And some of the things I saw there was we would get comments for the zoning bylaw amendment or site plan approval process, and we would make a resubmission, and all these new comments would show up. It's like, and then all of a sudden, you need to go get more studies, provide more information, and this cycle just kept going on and on and on, to the point where the project's almost, I think it's at its 10th or 11th submission. And that one specifically has been frustrating. Again, that's not my own project, but it's one thing I've seen.
What are they coming back with? Because obviously now they're much more pro-development than before, but is there something wrong with the plans? Is there something wrong with the lot? Like, that's pretty odd that it's been pushed back over a period of over a decade.
Yeah, and like, in all fairness, like the developer that has it now didn't own it for the whole time. That's only been the last couple of years. So a good chunk of that was a previous owner, and I can't fully speak to how hard they pushed it. But some of the stuff would be where in one submission they might want you to annex a little strip of land to the city for a walkway, where that wasn't on the comments the first time. Stuff like that, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, you need more survey. And then at times, they want to know that piece of land you're giving to them is clean, right? It doesn't need remediation. So something like that can really derail a project. Now, on this one specifically, yeah, there was some stuff like that. Other things the city said yes to or didn't really raise as a concern, but then raised it as a concern on the next submission. And sometimes that's with staff turning over and somebody new raising new concerns.
So it's not even an issue of fitting in, 11 townhouses. Like, even if it was 5 or 6 townhouses, they're still, it's not really an issue of the build. It's more so they're worried about whatever, like the land, if there needs remediation, et cetera, et cetera. Is that right? So like the 11 unit doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, there was no real pushback on the adding townhouses there. It was everything surrounding that, in environmental and survey and a bit of the built form, infrastructure, addressing. Addressing surprisingly held this thing up for far too long because it kind of fronted onto two streets and there was a difference of opinion on how to name all the townhouses.
So, Dan, I'm just curious, because obviously the Severance project went for quite some time. The 6 you did, you know, that zoning changes really did benefit you, right? But where does your stance on, like, where is the opportunity right now in development, right? And, you know, obviously we're hearing a lot more people do the 4+1 in Toronto. We're hearing a lot more multifamily construction happening in, call it, secondary markets, right? Like larger, like 10, 15, you know, apartment buildings, that type of stuff, right? You're talking about some of the smaller towns and the changes that are happening there with regards to their own local zoning laws and stuff like that, and rental shortages there. Outer province, we had someone else on earlier today that was kind of talking about outer province development, right? But just wondering, in your opinion, where do you kind of see the opportunity in today's market?
I think a lot of it is kind of what we've talked about. It's taking a property and adding a bunch of units to it, whether that's 4+1 like Toronto is allowing. But I think the kind of the ace in the hole when it comes to that is if you can also sever it. And if you can get two lots out of that, if you can tear down a house on a 80-foot wide lot, get two lots out of it, build four units on each, and potentially get a garden suite, you'll walk away with a home run every time if you're able to do that.
Do you think you need the 80 or do you think you can go with lower?
Toronto, you can go with lower. Some of these, I find the bigger the city, the smaller they're willing to allow the piece of land to be.
Right. Right. I think Kitchener just brought up the four units as well, where they're working on finalizing the four unit legality stuff behind it, right? But so is that kind of where you're seeing the highest potential is by existing single families, ideally that you can sever the lot, even if it's not a traditional, like sever it to the side of the house and keep the existing house. It's, you know, you might have to tear down the house, but if you can squeeze two lots out of it, right? Whether maybe it's Kitchener, like a 60, 70 or Toronto, or like a 50, right? And then go for two fourplexes, basically.
I've always argued that tearing down the house doesn't pencil out very well. And that was true in the past. But if cities are going to start allowing you to get that many units out of a single property, tearing down absolutely starts to make sense. If you're going from one house to what could be eight units. And on the note of Kitchener here, I have a duplex on a big corner lot here in Kitchener. And I will absolutely be looking to add additional units to that as well.
Perfect. No, thanks. I think that makes a lot of sense. So usually at this point in the podcast, we want to ask your guests two questions. The first question is, I'm going to change this up a little bit for you, like I did earlier today as well. For someone that wants to get into the space of development, severance, infill, multiplex, kind of ground up-ish like development, right? Where do you think they get started, right? And think of the average individual that maybe has 200 to 300, maybe has another friend that has 100, right? Like, how would you get started in today's market?
Why, you always describe your situation. Are you the friend that has 100 or 200 to 300?
No, I got like 25 grand out.
I'd say the lowest hanging fruit is adding units to an existing property. It's doing a garden suite in the rear yard. It's doing an addition off the back and sticking two more units in there. I think that's the most attainable way. And the nice thing with that is when there's already a house there, you're able to get A-rate financing on that. And you're able to potentially put tenants in the existing house. So you don't have a massive burn rate like you would on a vacant piece of land. You might have no burn rate if you do it right. So that I think is the most attainable way. And I would say next to that would be to find a larger property where you can keep the house, do the same thing, fix it up, put a tenant in there, and then sever excess land. Now, like I said, those kind of projects, you might have to look in smaller centers, but it's a real tangible way to get into this.
Well, yeah, why do you think we're not seeing more, instead of people doing full ground up development on the 4+1, like why are they not doing an addition onto a bungalow and just like adding two units on the back?
I don't know, because I'm about to do that realistically. So I'm curious myself on that.
Yeah, I really don't even have an answer. So I'm just curious now, but something to look into. Okay, perfect. And Dan, for over the next kind of like 2 to 3 years, where do you see your investing, your development? Where do you see it going with regards to your own goals?
I want to keep picking up projects like the ones I've talked about, but I do want to keep getting progressively bigger. So like I started by kind of severing one lot, and then I built four units. Then I'm trying to build six units, and I want to just keep going up, up, and up with that. I'd like to take on more projects too. So I've done a lot of take on a project, finish it up, take on a project, finish it up, with some overlap in there. But I've got the capacity and a pretty good skill set. So I'd like to just keep taking on more and more as I go along.
Awesome. Really appreciate you jumping on, Dan. It's incredible to see your journey. I mean, only 2 years ago, you were getting started with this process. 2 years later, you have basically 10 new developments that you're going to be working on, 10 units of new development. Plus the Wasaga one, we didn't touch on that too much. That's a couple of extra units there too, I assume.
That was a straight up land flip. I severed a lot, fixed up the house, sold the house. And yeah, just a nice, simple land flip on that one.
Right. So you're building off of your strength, starting off with land flips and then realizing, look, I can get land super cheap, cheaper than most people because I have this skill set, and then pivoting it over into development. It's awesome to hear how you're doing it in secondary markets as well, because a lot of people sort of get scared off from it. But that being said, there's opportunities there for investors who want to take advantage of that. If people want to connect with you, learn more about your story, how could they best do so?
The best way is to reach out on Instagram. My handle is illes_invest. So ILLES_invest. Or they can reach out on Facebook as well under my name.
Awesome. If you guys enjoyed this podcast episode, make sure to share with a friend, like, comment, show Dan some love on his social media as well. It helps continue to bring great guests out. And until next time, everyone, invest smarter and live better. Take care, all.